It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. Now we go to this 10-acre farm on the Oneida Nation Reservation. Became a reality in 2017. A couple that became hooked when planting white corn a couple years earlier in their backyard, the story goes. And they started on this journey to get to know Native foodways, the complex significance of connecting to their ancestors through food, and to spread those methods of planting and harvesting, seed saving and preparing the meals. Join in 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Becky and Steve Webster, co-founders of Ngwonkwa, that translates as our foods. Welcome to you both to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having us.
Good morning.
Good morning. Becky, let's start with you. What is happening on your farm this time of year? Take us to it.
This time of year, we are getting ready for our harvest. We've pulled off most of the corn from our fields, and we're bringing in some beans. Hopefully, we'll wrap up harvest here within the next few weeks.
Where does that corn go once you bring it in?
Well, we first take the husks off of the corn, then we braid that corn so it can dry for a few months. And then we will shell the corn, and we'll either eat it as a family, we'll trade it with community members, or we cook it up as we host events here on our farmstead.
On your farmstead, I looked at your farmstead kitchen. What a story there. Steve, both of you did such of the labor of building this farmstead kitchen. Can you describe it to us?
Yeah, the last...
Oh, I'm sorry, Steve, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. The last 5 years, my father-in-law, Becky's dad, he's the real construction guy, but he's been there with us, and it's pretty much been a nonstop construction project for the last 5 years to get to this point.
And so can you explain, though, what the farmstead kitchen is? Because you basically started with a single stainless steel table from your family, but you built this whole building that's trying to do a lot of things. Can you tell us about that, Steve?
Yeah, the kitchen was something that we kind of saw a need that came up as we started growing the foods and we started figuring out how to do this. The next phase became, how do we cook this and get these foods into our community? We were heavily leaning on some of the our nation's public kitchens that you could rent out, but with COVID they were shut down, so we really struggled, and that kind of kickstarted the concept and idea of creating this kitchen for not only us to cook our food, but also teach people how to process and preserve these foods as well. That's not common knowledge. That's not something you can just go to Google and look up. So that was kind of our initial direction, I guess.
Becky, what do you love about bringing the harvest into this kitchen?
I just love being able to know that we planted these seeds and we cared for the land. We weeded these plants as they were growing. And so we saw this food from the whole cycle of it all. And it hits different when you know and you're preparing food that you've cared for yourselves. I'm sure lots of other farmers and backyard gardeners know that same feeling, that when you're able to eat and share the food that you have grown, it's a pretty remarkable feeling.
How do you see, Becky, how do you see food as a gift? Because most of the time in our distracted, fast lives, I miss the honor of the food. I don't really connect with it.
Well, we see food a little bit differently because we see them as our relatives. Hmm. So they have these great responsibilities to fulfill, either as seeds to bring forth the next generation or as our foods to nourish our body and our minds. And our foods are really bringing our communities and our families together again, to be able to talk about those foods, why we grow them. And also it's bringing back a whole lot of our history, our culture, our language, so that we think of food as a safe way to have those conversations about the different impacts that colonization, assimilation, and removal have had on our people.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Oneida Farm, Ngwonkwa, the foods with its founders, Becky and Steve Webster. You can join in on Native practices, food preparation, planting, harvesting, the work of seed saving, 800-642-1234. Steve, why did you and Becky start this farm?
Well, we both have our own separate reasons. And one of the things that kind of like triggered everything was when my dad passed away, we were both at doing the 9-to-5, chasing the almighty dollar. And that kind of really, really reset our priorities. It became a couple discussions about, you know, how do we want to spend the rest of our lives? The classic midlife crisis, I guess you could say. And it came up and we started talking around, you know, at night about homeschooling our kids and starting this farm and so forth. So that was kind of like my initial trigger to kind of go down this path.
How about you, Becky? What did starting this farm mean for you? What was going on inside you?
It had a lot to do with those same reasons. But in addition, the idea of regaining our culture, our language, our history through our foods, because we had the situations in Oneida where the tribal farm, Junhinqua, wasn't growing enough food for everybody, and people would get really mad at the tribe for not growing enough food. And we thought that was a little bit crazy that you're going to rely on the government to do that. And we took the teachings from Junhinqua because they really showed us how to care for our foods. That's where we learned everything. And we took that knowledge and we said, we're going to be a part of the solution to help more people. We formed with some other families a co-op to grow our indigenous white corn together. And as a family, we decided to do things here on our farmstead as well. Just the more people doing these things in our community, the better.
I love at the end of your YouTube videos, which are just beautiful, by the way, really give me a sense of what's happening at the farm. You crowdsource and you say, if you have food methods you want to share, reach out. What have you learned through those words of, you know, teach me your way or share, please?
So we've had all kinds of different ways to do things. We've learned multiple ways on how to process our corn. And these are things that, you know, we always think that we just don't know about them. And we ask other community members and they say, we didn't know that either. And then we start discussion about, oh yeah, actually so-and-so used to do that. So it's really helping us start that conversation and rekindling memories that some people in our community hadn't really thought about in a while. So we have been able to track down other ways on how to cook and prepare our foods, which is just adding to the diversity of the different ways that we can eat them.
And the diversity of varieties. Steve, you're growing heirloom varieties. How are these different from what we would find in grocery stores?
Becky is actually better suited for answering that.
Okay, we're going to punt that to Becky. Go ahead.
So our seeds are entirely different. They are the same seeds that have been handed down from family to family since before European contact. So these seeds have a long history. They're not genetically modified, and there is an incredible amount of diversity within our seeds, how they grow, the different nutrients that each one has. And if you look at what's available commercially, there isn't a whole lot there. Even if you look at the seed catalogs from like early 1900s, there was a lot more variety then. But it's not just the seeds themselves, it's how we care for them. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of concern that we have with the way food is conventionally cared for with herbicides and pesticides and just the way the land is not being cared for. So we think that there's a big difference in these foods and these seeds and how we grow and care for them. And then just the different nutritional value that they have and knowing that we're helping to heal the earth as we're growing these foods instead of damaging it.
Becky and Steve Webster with us sharing the vision for their Oneida farmstead, Unkwakwa, the full name meaning our foods, where we plant things. The property named by an Oneida faith keeper. Join in on indigenous farming practices, rehapping the land, exploring Native American foodways. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore Indigenous farming practices, the seeds that establish food sovereignty, and the mission of Ngwankwa, a 10-acre farmstead created through the vision of Becky and Steve Webster, citizens of the United Nation. Join in on planting and growing, harvesting, seed saving, and Indigenous food preparation ways. 800-642-1234. Becky and Steve, stay with us. So, Steve, what does food sovereignty mean to you?
Oh, geez, that's a pretty big question.
Mm-hmm, it is.
For me, there's a lot of things and a lot of layers going on that I could like talk at length that about it from my perspective, and Becky's going to have some thoughts on this, but that, for me, it's about, a community initiative. A lot of times, like, people kind of try to format that term food sovereignty as something that, like, if the Walmarts and Woodman's grocery stores all around were to just suddenly run out of food, that we could just like feed ourselves. That is some of it, in my opinion, to me. But where I get at too is, there's a lot of things that need to happen before we could realistically kind of get to that point. And almost all of it depends on exposure and talking about these foods and having some infrastructure in place, having a community that's open and knowledgeable about these ways, having access to seeds, fertile soil, and tools, even two things. And again, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole of food addiction. You know, and those are all things that I guess kind of encompass food sovereignty in a nutshell for me.
So many inputs and variables wrapped into it. Becky, your thoughts on food sovereignty?
Yeah, it's mostly just being able to do things on our own terms and in ways that are culturally appropriate for us to do so without interference from outside folks. And I think we're able finally in this day and age to be able to do that and reclaim a lot of those farming practices and to care for our foods in ways that make sense for us.
One of those ways is through seeds, as you were talking about, and you're so careful in keeping records of your seeds and tracking where they come from and how they grow. And interesting, I thought, that their name and their story. Can you tell us about this work of seed saving?
Yeah, it's a really a labor of love. And it started out several years ago when we were just beginning our caring for our Indigenous foods. And we would go to seed exchanges and, oh, I'll remember what this is. And, oh, I know what that is. And, you know, come next season when it's planting time, what is this? So I think it's so important to keep really good records. And not only that, because when you share them with other people, they're going to want to know the history and the story of those seeds and how they came to be. Because like I mentioned, there are living relatives. They're not just something, some commodity to be exchanged, that they're meant to be cared for and so that they can fulfill their responsibilities.
Your seed mentor told you the most dangerous place for a seed is on the shelf. What did she mean by that?
That our seeds are our living relatives, and they are meant to be planted and they're meant to be cared for. They're not meant to sit as a collection somewhere in some seed vault somewhere. They're meant to be cared for. And knowing that our seeds are living little beings, that they have a shelf life. If we don't care for them and keep them in rotation in the gardens, they might not be able to germinate if we wait too long. So by having them just sitting, waiting and waiting on the shelf, they might not be able to fulfill those responsibilities to bring forth the next generation.
Going back out on the crops now, Steve, this is something farmers really struggle with, they grapple with. How do you keep down weeds? How do you rehab the land, but also make sure that these crops thrive?
For us, it's we don't use pesticide or herbicide, and it's kind of been a learning experience on there. There's a lot of information out there about how to organically tackle this, but here we're at such a scale. What we do is we do a majority of our planting in three sister mounds, and we do a lot of hand weeding. We do a lot of, actually it's all hand weeding. We kind of stumbled across some concepts that have really, really helped with that, which is like collecting our lawn clippings and basically using them to create like almost like a layer around the Three Sister Mounds to really help with weed suppression and moisture retention. It's one of the challenges that I kind of half joke about is that in every direction around me, conventional farming knowledge is in every direction and at my fingertips on YouTube. But when it comes to growing these traditional foods and with these traditional styles, it takes a lot of work. You got to look for that stuff and feel out what works and what doesn't.
Mm. A little bit of trial and error. I wonder, in the years since, have you seen your soil change? Have you seen that rehabilitation?
Yes, we've seen some changes. Uh-huh. We got a ways to go. I think some of the lessons that I'm kind of slowly learning in this journey on these foods is that I have to think in terms of multiple seasons out. Mm-hmm. There is something too about the whole seven generation mindset. And so I'm still used to and have to unlearn that I'm going to be able to do something and my soil is just going to be amazing, you know, by next growing season. So we went from a very dead soil to something that I noticed has actually changed in particular in the Three Sister Mounds too. Like it looks like a more vibrant, healthier, hardier soil than what we started out with, which was just basically a dead clay, only weeds growing in it pretty much kind of soil. So,
wow. Becky, can you explain why you call it Three Sister Mounds?
Yeah, so we plant our corn, beans, and squash together in the mounds because they have a symbiotic relationship and they grow together and support each other. So the corn grows tall and strong in the middle. The beans are planted right next to each corn stalk and they grow up the corn stalk and the beans provide nitrogen to the soil. And around the outside of our mounds is where we plant our squash, and the squash we like to say is one of the most underrated sisters, because anybody that's ever gardened knows how prickly the leaves and stems are of the squash, which helps keep the animals out. But her big leaves also help keep moisture in the soil and shade out the sun. So it also helps with weed suppression.
We're talking with Becky and Steve Webster. They founded a 10-acre farm, Oneida Nation Reservation. It's called Ungwaqua. You can join in at 800-642-1234. So, Steve, are you selling or trading the harvest, the food? How does that work?
We actually got something kind of unique where we really don't sell our corn that we grow. We've really been pushing for trade, and there's a lot to that. So one of the things is that we are really challenging our community to kind of come up with think in terms of the trade. And one of the things I always use an example of is that a lot of times when people come up and ask us for corn, that the first we tell them and explain to them that we only trade for it, is the first thing that comes out of their mouths is, well, I have nothing of value. And it's like kind of like a, for me personally, it's like a echo of boarding school stuff. And again, it's kind of like your mind is only set up to thinking like what is my dollar value? Mm. And so what we do is we kind of use that in a way to kind of force that conversation, coax out of them that you do have value and you are a part of this community. And so there's a lot of things that we've traded for in the past. So like giving you an example, we've traded for like singing lessons for my daughters. We've traded for haircuts. We've traded for hot meals. I told you before that we've pretty much been building this farm by hand and we don't have a lot of time to, you know, cook supper every night. And so a hot meal is gold to us. We've even traded for like some modern things. I'm an 80s kid. So I traded one time some white corn for a He-Man castle. As a kid. So and that's really and I'm really excited about that, approaching that and pushing that in our community, because there's a lot of people who want to be a part of the, like what you mentioned before, the food sovereignty aspect of this. But you know, they live in an apartment, they aren't going to be able to build a 10-acre farm, and they really want to help, and this is kind of like their way of jumping in and helping us, like, you know, and they get to be a part of it, and to see that come out of them of like when they say I don't have any value, and you coax out of them, I'm like, well, I got artwork, I know how to bead, I can do pots, I can do baskets, I can come help you weed. That's a pretty cool thing to watch somebody get empowered. And so that's all possible because of the training we've been pushing.
Oh, what a transformation. Land and people together. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Becky and Steve Webster, co-founders of Ngwakwa on the United Nation Reservation near De Pere. We have a link to their nonprofit at WPR.org/mornings. Up ahead, bow hunting season underway. We'll get some pointers and tips, excuse the pun, from the director, WASA director of the Wisconsin Bow Hunters Association. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Archery and crossbow deer hunting season is underway. The State Department of Natural Resources, the DNR, it publishes safety tips for hunters like treat every bow and crossbow as if it were loaded. Always point them in a safe direction. Join in on archery and crossbow season, your experiences with the opener 5 days ago, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Mike Brust is here, WASA director for the Wisconsin Bow Hunters Association. The organization's mission is to promote, preserve, and protect the sport for over 80 years. Mike, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you.
Good morning. Last year, bow and crossbow hunters harvested nearly 100,000 deer. That's down from a 2020 peak of over 113,000 we saw there in COVID. What conditions are hunters facing this year?
Well, so far, so good. There are places in the state where there are quite a few deer and other places where there aren't so many, but we had a relatively mild winter up here, so we're hopeful that the population will be stable.
And you went hunting over the opening weekend. How did it go?
Actually, I've been out a couple times, including last evening.
Oh, okay.
At this point in the season, I'm more just kind of trying to figure out what the deer patterns are and things like that. But I've seen a couple does, but we don't have a lot of deer up here in north central Wisconsin. So just seeing a deer is kind of a bonus, but it's the season goes on till into November, so hopefully I'll have some chances in that time.
That's what I'm wondering. I mean, when does it really get serious for you? When does it kind of heat up?
Well, by about the middle of October, the bucks are more active, and even the does are a little more active. But it's really too warm now for. I don't have a walk-in cooler, and if I shoot a deer, one of the main things I'm interested in is the meat from the deer, and when it's this warm, or at least as of yesterday when it was that warm, there is a risk of losing some of the meat to spoilage. So that's another reason I'm not real serious about it until it cools down a little bit also.
How do you recommend practicing to gear up for the season and really master your shot execution before you go out? Do you practice before the season?
I do. I practice quite a bit. In fact, Wisconsin Bowhunters Association had our annual broadhead shoot at the beginning of the month, and got to practice there. I also practice at Rib Mountain Bowman throughout the summer. So, yeah, I practice quite a bit. I shoot a recurve bow instinctively, so it's a little more of a challenge to keep in shape and practice so that I am accurate when the season comes around. I for probably 30 years I did shoot a compound with sights, but I switched back 6 or 7 years ago just to make it a little more challenging, give me a little more excuse to be out hunting.
And just for context, you've been a hunter for more than a half century. And I think that really gives you some perspective, because Wisconsin held its first bow hunting season in 1934, and your association really reflects the heritage and tradition, you know, looking at Roy Case and Aldo Leopold. Can you help us understand a little bit of the tradition?
Absolutely. Wisconsin Bow Hunters is the oldest state bow hunting organization in the country, and actually the largest. And it was started back in 1941 by people like Roy Case and Aldo Leopold and others that really tried to convince the DNR, the Conservation Department at that time, that it is a viable alternative to firearms hunting. And it was also developed to, like you said, preserve and protect the sport, and really at that time kind of introduce it to the public. And so one of the big things that our organization has been very, very strong about is making sure that we protect the ethics of the sport, because if it's considered something that's not ethical, it really wouldn't be accepted by the public, and it was. But one of the things that was a concern at first is an arrow wouldn't dispatch a deer cleanly, and clearly that's been shown not to be the case. So it's an organization that has thrived throughout over 80 years and is still doing well.
We're discussing the bow hunting season in Wisconsin, the history of it as well. Mike Brust is here, WASA director of the Wisconsin Bow Hunters Association. You can join in 800-642-1234. Mike, along those lines, some say that bow hunting is a more humane type of sport hunting because it pits the hunter against the animal on more equal ground. I wonder how you see it.
Well, like I say, I started out hunting with a recurve before compound bows were actually invented. Did okay then, and then when compounds came out, I switched to those and did fine. But in the last 6 or 7 years, I've been shooting a recurve again because it really does get me close to the animal. My shots are under 20 yards, and so I need an animal to be very close. And so it's, to me, it adds to the challenge and the satisfaction of being very close to an animal and being able to observe a lot of different animals before I have an opportunity to shoot one.
What does a bow hunter do if they wound but don't kill the deer?
Well, one of the things that an arrow does, a sharp broadhead does, is it causes blood loss. Mm-hmm. And if that's the only way it causes the deer to die. And so generally, if you do shoot a deer and it leaves a blood trail, you can recover the deer. If you don't create enough blood loss, although the deer may bleed for a little bit, it usually doesn't leave enough of a blood trail and generally recovers. So it's been shown through many studies that it is a very effective and clean and humane way to harvest a deer.
Crossbow hunting season goes on at the same time as bow hunting, and crossbow hunters have harvested more antler deer than bow hunters for the last 5 years. Should crossbows have a separate, shorter season from bow hunting?
Well, that's been a matter of discussion for actually since 2013 when the law was passed. Our position is that we have no problems with crossbows. They are a viable weapon, and they like bow hunters are trying to establish their season and find a viable season for their weapon. As far as the length of the season, one of the things that history has shown is that bow hunters in their season that runs from mid-September to the end of the year, and gun hunters who basically have the 90 season in November, have a success rate on bucks that's almost identical from year to year. And so one of the problems with crossbows is they are much more effective and longer range weapon. And their success over these last 5 years has been, in most cases, more than double that of either gun hunters or bow hunters. So the concern is that that season should be adjusted somehow to provide the same kind of success rate that both bow hunters and gun hunters also enjoy.
A technicality here, do they require separate licenses through the DNR?
Yes. Okay. The bow hunting license or the crossbow hunting license has a set fee, and then to get the other license, if you want to hunt with both, is an additional $3.
What is the tax? You just mentioned distance, crossbow, you don't have to get as close. What is the tactical difference between hunting with a crossbow versus a bow and arrow?
Well, hunting with a bow and arrow involves being able to pull the bow back with your own strength and being able to hold it out at arm's length steady and make an accurate shot. Crossbows are generally drawn with a mechanical device, so they can store much more power, and they can be rested, and so it's a matter of basically just pulling the trigger like a firearm to release their bolt. So from a mechanical standpoint, that's the big difference, and really it relates to range and accuracy more than anything.
Mike Brust with us, a leader with the Wisconsin Bow Hunters Association, a hunter for more than 50 years, advocating for the sport, the association, a voice on DNR wildlife management committees. Join in on crossbow and bow questions. What you want to know about hunting with arrows, taking deer, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Archery season is underway in Wisconsin, runs through January 8th. We're getting perspective on how to advance the sport of hunting with a bow and arrow. Join in on archery and crossbow deer season, this first opportunity to pursue deer this fall. The gear, the bow, the case, release, arrows, what you've experienced, 800-642-1234. Mike Brust is WASA Director of the Wisconsin Bow Hunters Association and stays with us. Let's bring on a call. Jim is joining us from Baldwin. Jim, what would you like to share?
Oh, you were talking about length of season and, everybody getting a fair shake at it, but there's so many deer in Wisconsin. In the last year and a half, I killed one with a vehicle and had my car dented and had injured deer run off on two other occasions. And I'm a hunter, but actually I've been picking up roadkill deer because it's quicker and easier for me to do that. You call the sheriff's department and they'll notify you if there's a fresh roadkill. But I'm thinking about going out and shooting a lot of deer this year just because it's a lot more humane for them to die by a bullet or archery than being hit by vehicles. And it would also help reduce CWD and increase the health of the deer herd not to have such a large deer herd in the state.
Jim, thank you for that perspective. Mike, and we haven't talked yet about chronic wasting disease, but go ahead on what Jim is observing.
Well, Jim, one of the things that I think is important to note is that in obviously in your area, there are a lot of deer. Unfortunately, in other parts of the state, there are very few deer. So one of the challenges for the department is to be able to kind of regulate the herd so that it's not excessive in certain areas. And that's a challenge. And so there are, you know, different things they do to promote that, issuing more antlerless permits in those areas and things like that. I've lived in Wisconsin my whole life and have actually never hit a deer with my vehicle. But again, I live up north where we don't have as many deer.
What about CWD? The DNR saying nearly all counties in the state are affected. How does chronic wasting disease affect where people hunt?
Well, one of the things that happened when it was first discovered is a lot of hunters became very concerned that it was something that could be transmitted to humans, and hunting, the hunting license sales dropped pretty considerably early in the 2000s. It has since been shown that it can't be transmitted to humans, or it never has been. But as far as the population of deer, yeah, there are some places in the state, primarily down in, say, the Richland County area, where there's a high concentration of CWD. It has affected the population somewhat, but the population, even in those areas, is still okay. But yeah, it is a concern. It is something that we as hunters are very concerned about, because we hate to see any animal suffer, and CWD is a terrible way for an animal to die.
Jim, thank you for the call. Katie now in Eau Claire. Katie, hi.
Good morning. I am I guess I would call myself still a novice, even though I've been hunting for like 6 to 8 years at this point. But I wanted to comment that I oftentimes fill my tags because I'm able to contact local butchers where I live in Eau Claire and have the deer butchered and donated to various food pantries around our city. And I'm wondering if there are other communities that allow that to happen and how that information can get disseminated to different hunters.
Oh, Katie, thank you so much. Mike, is there any information there?
Excellent question. Excellent point. I actually process my own deer, and we consume them just in our family. But there are, and I wish I knew the exact name of the program, but the DNR helps facilitate that throughout the state. So if you do have a situation where you are able to donate a deer, contact the Department of Natural Resources. There is a program, and I don't know the name of it offhand, where that is an option for you. And it's a great option. It really helps those that really need extra protein.
It's called Wisconsin's Deer Donation Program. And I just Googled it. But yes, if you Google DNR Deer and Donation Program, it should come up. Katie, thank you for that. Let's go to Carl now in Cecil. Carl, hi.
Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning. What's on your mind?
Well, I'd like to know if I read articles where you're able to get a dog that tracks wounded deer, and their success rate is like 95-97%. They smell, they go by scent and not by blood. A lot of times when you hit a deer, you can't, the blood trail quits and you can't find the deer. Is there hounds or available or a place available in Wisconsin where you can call and possibly get a dog that tracks wounded deer, and if there's a charge for it?
Carl, thank you. Mike?
Another great question. And Kate, if you're able to Google this, I think it's called Wisconsin Blood Trackers. And there is a whole network of people who have tracking dogs and that are able to help recover deer that can't be recovered by following a blood trail. And yes, it is quite successful, but there are, like you say, a whole network of these people throughout the state, and I think it's through a website called Wisconsin Blood Trackers.
Yes, United Blood Trackers, Wisconsin United Blood Trackers.
And another great service. Some of them charge, you know, for their time and their gas. Others do it just to help people out. But there's usually one within, you know, 50 miles of wherever you're hunting. So certainly if you can't recover your deer by following the blood trail, contact, you know, the closest one, or, you know, one or two, to find out if they can come and help. Usually, even if it's the next morning, they can help recover the deer. And again, sometimes the deer isn't fatally wounded and they wouldn't recover it. But in most cases, if it is fatally wounded, they will be able to recover it.
Carl, thanks for that. As we talk with Mike Brust, WASA Director of the Wisconsin Bow Hunters Association. Chuck now in Plainfield with a question. Chuck, what's on your mind?
Good morning, Kate, Mike. I was wondering if they have any other game that you're allowed to hunt with bull in Wisconsin that requires special license or anything?
I can answer that. The special license requirements are for animals like deer, bear, bobcat, pretty much any game that you can harvest with a firearm other than certain trapped animals. You can also hunt with a bull, but animals like fishers and beaver and things like that that can only be trapped can't be harvested with either a bull or a gun. But pretty much anything you can harvest with a firearm, you can also harvest with a bull.
You had said in your elk season report here that history was made in this upcoming elk season since Wisconsin Bow Hunters Association, a member, has drawn an elk harvest permit. What are challenges with hunting larger game with a bow?
Very similar to deer hunting or any other hunting. I've hunted elk with a bow out west, and again, it's just a point of making an accurate shot.
How do you like to fix your venison?
We particularly like the tenderloins and the back straps, but pretty much do a lot of roasts, ground meat, and unfortunately, when our kids were younger, we could go through four deer a year. Now it's just myself and my wife, and we pretty much consume just the two deer a year. And at this point in time, I'm ready to shoot another one because we're out of meat.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Mike Brust is WASA Director for the Wisconsin Bow Hunters Association. Just ahead, it's a book conversation discussing the female body and organ systems beyond reproduction. The book is called Vagina Obscura. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.